Welcome to the African American Experience, a monthly program celebrating the artistic, cultural, and historic contributions of African Americans. This program has been created and produced by the Audio Journal's Roy Allen Project to carry on the work and vision of its namesake. Roy Allen was an extraordinary human being who deeply touched the lives of his family, his friends, and his colleagues. He was a trailblazer for African Americans in the fields of theater, radio, and television. In carrying on Roy's vision to inspire the black community to a sense of pride and power in its achievements, and to share those achievements with all of the community, we present the African American Experience. On today's edition of African American Experience, we take a special look at Marshall Major Taylor, the first African-American world's champion bicycle racer who lived and trained in the city of Worcester. The pride and commitment felt by the residents of Worcester is reflected in the unveiling of a monument dedicated to Major Taylor on May 21st, 2008. Audio Journal's African-American Experience brings you to this remarkable event and reflects on the importance of this world champion to his family, his race, his sport, and his community. 100 years ago, when bicycle races drew crowds that filled Madison Square Garden, the biggest draw of all was Major Taylor. He was the Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods of his time. Taylor won his first race at the age of 13 in Indianapolis. Soon, bicycle manufacturer and former racer Lewis Birdie Munger hired Taylor as a factory helper and nurtured his racing career. Blacks were banned from the main cycling organization in the United States in 1894, just as bicycling's popularity surged. But the move stimulated the growth of black cycling clubs and black races, which gave Taylor his early opportunities to prove his ability. By the time Munger decided to set up a factory in Worcester, in part to take advantage of the biking boom, but also to find a more tolerant atmosphere for his black protege, Taylor was black champion of the United States. In 1897, the Colored Cyclone, as the newspapers called Taylor, had to abandon the quest to become national sprint points champion when Southern promoters refused an entry to key races. When he did compete, he faced hostility from white riders, including threats and physical assault. Taylor didn't lose his nerve or his popularity. He held 7 world's records in 1898 and won the world's championship in 1899. For years, he resisted invitations to compete in Europe because he refused to race on Sundays. He finally signed a European contract in 1901, was welcomed as a hero in France, and went on to beat every European champion. Major Taylor was one of the best paid blacks in America. But in his retirement, his fortune dwindled, his health deteriorated, and his family split up. He self-published his autobiography in 1929 and drove to Chicago, selling copies from his trunk. He lived at the Wabash Avenue YMCA and died at age 53 in poverty and obscurity. At the dedication ceremony we've recorded, you'll hear 3-time Tour de France winner Greg LeMond and 3-time Olympic medalist Edwin Moses as featured speakers at the public unveiling of the Major Taylor Memorial, as well as the living ancestors of this great man.
That was the New England Gospel Mass Choir, led by Eric Edmonds. Good afternoon and welcome to the great city of Worcester, where the sun is always shining. I'm City Manager Michael O'Brien. I'm honored to be a part of today's ceremony to pay tribute to one of our own local heroes, Marshall Major Taylor. We honor a man today that not only for his athletic feats, but for his legacies for the sport of cycling. But most important, we honor him for his character and the role he played in breaking down barriers in both professional sports and in life. As a city, we are most proud of his accomplishments and his ties to our very own community. The Worcester Whirlwind, as he's affectionately came to be known, was recognized for his pure speed and his ability to come from behind and to come out a winner, in spite of so many very difficult challenges. But Major Taylor was never truly recognized for his talents during the era for which he competed, not like what we see today with our athletes. But today, together and with such great leadership, we set the proper place in history and in our community with a monument to a man who was truly monumental. From this date, we are going to memorialize Marshal Major Taylor with a statue on this public land for perpetuity in a city that has been known throughout time for tolerance and understanding, in which he flourished as an athlete and as a person. On behalf of our great city, I'd like to welcome three-time Tour de France winner Greg LeMond and Olympic two-time gold medalist Edwin Moses to our great city. We're very proud to have you here with us. And I'd also like to take a moment to thank the Major Taylor Association for the decade-long effort to make today a reality, certainly perseverance and so many characteristics that you expect. God bless them for what they've done. As you'll see when this is unveiled, the memorial is a most fitting tribute. And I can only imagine that Major Taylor is looking down and smiling for what you've accomplished. The Major Taylor Association represents everything he stood and he worked for. I'd also like to note in our audience a gentleman who is a retired firefighter now for some 30 years, Jesse Owens, now 97 years old, came up and told me prior to the program that he probably is the only person in this audience that had the distinct privilege of shaking Major Taylor's hand during one of his road races here. Well, Jesse, where are you? There he is, 97 years old. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, the second Worcester Whirlwind, all known so well to us for what she's done over this past decade. This individual is tireless, perseverance is her middle name, Lynn Tolman of the Major Taylor Association. Lynn is a Worcester resident, a cyclist, a journalist, and she helped to spearhead this local effort to bring this monument to bear. In his biography on Major Taylor, author Todd Balfe called Lynn the other Worcester Whirlwind. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce Lynn Tolman.
Several of the distinguished guests that are sitting up front are now standing in applause of Lynn Tolman.
Thanks, Mike. That's very kind. And Eric and the choir, you're fantastic. It's been a long road. We're here to honor a great sprinter, but this has been more of a test of endurance than a show of speed. The real testament to Major Taylor's enduring legacy is the collective stature of the people here today. And I want to acknowledge some of our important guests. First of all, the flesh and blood legacy, three generations of Major Taylor's descendants are here. I'll tell you who they are. First, we have Major Taylor's grandson, General Dallas Brown, and his wife, Elizabeth. Three of Major Taylor's great-grandchildren, Greg Brown, Jan Brown, and Karen Brown Donovan. Karen's husband Dan and son Andrew and Jan's son Thomas Clark and Greg's wife Stacy and Jordan. Fine family. We're also honored to have several world-class athletes here and not just the Tour de France and Olympic stars that you'll hear from shortly. Please say hello to John Howard, 1981 Ironman World Champion, World Triathlon Champion. John rode his bike and he's back there. This is a return to Worcester for Howie. He was here in 1981 for the downtown Worcester Whirlwind bike race honoring Major Taylor. We're also very honored to have with us Nelson Vales, the cheetah. Nelson was the first African-American cyclist since Major Taylor to earn global acclaim. He won a silver medal in track cycling at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. Yeah. Major Taylor was inducted into the Hall of Fame posthumously in 1989, same year as John Howard. Great to have so many cycling people here. As I said, this finish line once looked very distant. The Major Taylor Association was formed 10 years ago this summer. I will say, without going into Major Taylor's entire biography, that his story really has something for everyone, that everyone who takes a moment to listen to or read or view something about the 1899 World Cycling Champion comes away with something that inspires them, something that opens their eyes, that really strikes them. His story is rags to riches. It's overcoming adversity of the worst sort, violent racial injustice. It's determination and perseverance from a young age. It's boom and bust. It's sticking to principles. And it's pure human strength. Physical power and strength of character. For me, what stands out is how Major Taylor walks such a tightrope. As a black athlete in a white man's world, he managed to succeed on his own terms. He faced closed doors and open hostility with remarkable dignity. And I think that's what you'll see in this monument. I know it's what you'll see because it's carved in, those words are carved in stone on this side. You know, Major Taylor often had to go it alone. Because of that dreadful monster prejudice, to use his own words, he didn't have allies on the track who could clear a path for him. His opponents often teamed up against him and blocked him in, or worse. It wasn't like the Tour de France you see nowadays, where the strongest rider has teammates to fend off attacks and set the pace and pull him in their slipstream. In short, to return to the cycling metaphor, the lead out for the sprint, a lot of people have been pulling for a long way, and now it's time for the champion to shine. And it's my pleasure to introduce another person who played a key role in funding this monument, State Representative John Benenda.
Thank you, Lynn, and what a beautiful Worcester day it is. You know, coming down here today from the State House, I got to thinking about all of the hatred that was shown in 1947 when Jackie Robinson, the first black baseball player, broke into the Major League with the Dodgers. How was it in 1900? And in 1870s and 80s and 90s, right after the Civil War, how was it for Marshal Major Taylor? It had to be unbearable. And to his ancestors who are with us today, I thank each and every one of you for your perseverance over the years, for what you have had to hear about the treatment that your great, great grandfather, received in this world. And today it's only fitting that we unveil this monument. As Major Taylor said when he first came to Worcester, he liked the fact that because he was black, they didn't bar him from races. And if you look here today, you will see white and black Americans and Worcesterites here. And what a tribute that is, that many, many years ago, before the turn of the century, this man who we're about to see was proud to call Worcester his home. 1 month ago from today, on June 21st, he died at 53 years of age. And the way he died was not very nice either, for those who know. Basically in poverty. And you look today at the pays of Derek Jeter and Manny Ramirez and all of the great athletes, whatever sport they're in, they'll never have to die like that. But Marshal Taylor was true, a man of his time and way before his time. I am so happy that I've been asked to fill in for Senator Chandler, who is in the State House right now working on the budget. Ladies and gentlemen, Harriet's not here, but her husband, Burton Bud Chandler, is here. I don't have to introduce him. You all know one of the greatest lawyers in the city of Worcester. Ladies and gentlemen, Bud Chandler.
That introduction is worth a fortune to me. I really do appreciate it. I would just like to say a few things about my thoughts on Major Taylor himself. Back in the time of Major Taylor, all of the indignities he suffered, and he suffered, if you read, I was astonished when I read the book when I became involved by Mr. Ritchie, I think, to see that Major Taylor, when he raced, right there on the track, his competitors would insult him, abuse him, sometimes push him, and sometimes shove him. And think of the frustration that this man must have felt. We can talk about his dignity, and we do that correctly. But just think for a moment, put yourself in his place. The horrors of suffering continual discrimination. And he did it for several years, or more than several years, many years. And there was no place to go. There was no hope. And for a man to accomplish what he accomplished under those circumstances, I think is truly a measure of the man as well as his athletic skills. Thanks very much.
Has said this, but this will be the first and only monument in the city of Worcester in honor of an African-American person. That's huge. That is absolutely huge. I come from one of those families that's one of the longtime Worcester families. Not only was my mother born in Worcester, but my grandmother was born in Worcester. So we've been around. Black folks have been in Worcester for a long time. And this is the first monument so that school children from the Worcester Public Schools will be able to come down to the library, do research, and study and look at a work of a wonderful man who is an example for all of us about perseverance. And I am absolutely thrilled and honored to be able to express appreciation on behalf of the community for this wonderful tribute to this fine athlete and African American of our community. As people mentioned, Major Taylor was a very religious man. I think that's how he was able to withstand all of the abuse and turn the other cheek so many times throughout his entire life, was because of his religious values. At this point, though, I'm going to pass on the microphone to a man that I came to know when he was the program director for the Greater Worcester Community Foundation. Richard Ward left Worcester to go on to be the director of grant making for the Boston Foundation. But he is a tremendous athlete in his own right. He actually was an All-American track and field star and qualified for the 1984 Olympics, and I'm told even competed against Edwin Moses, the nerve of him. But let's bring him up, Mr. Richard Ward.
Thank you all very much. It is indeed an honor and a pleasure to be here back in Worcester today for this event for a couple of reasons. One, because of Major Taylor himself. I am a closet cyclist. I get out every week, probably anywhere between 35 and 50 miles a week on the weekend. So a weekend warrior on the bicycles cycle. And I wish I was out there this morning with you guys when you were riding the roads, but I couldn't get here early enough. The other reason why I'm excited to be here, because I get a chance to really introduce my idol, and I had a chance to talk to Edwin for about 15 minutes prior to this introduction, and it took every ounce of me not to really talk about what I really wanted to say in this presentation. I kind of have a history that goes back that he's not aware of. Back in 1983, when I was an athlete at Boston University, I had a chance to qualify and go on to the U.S. Track and Field Championships and compete in the 400-meter intermediate hurdles. And I was this young kid from Boston who I've done well in terms of the track field, but this was the first time I'd ever been on a stage that big in front of so many people, in front of some of the greatest athletes in the world. And believe me, that my head was spinning the whole time. And I remember going the day I got there, I decided to go to the track, and I looked at the heat sheet to see where I was going to be the next day racing. And I knew there was a good chance that I was going to be in the race with Edwin Moses, but I just wasn't sure. So I get to the track that morning, and I look at the heat sheets, and I look up, and I see Edwin Moses in lane 4, and I'm like, wow, there he is, right? And then I looked, and I saw myself in lane 5, and I went, oh, goodness, you know, what am I doing? I asked, what did I, you know, I kind of got my dream, what I asked for. So anyway, I was all excited. In fact, Edwin had this amazing streak going of consecutive victories in a track and field event. So I went home, back to the hotel, went to bed early as if that was going to help somehow, you know, that morning. And I got up the next day and was just so excited to sort of be there and race that day. So when I got out there and I was, you know, warming up, and Edwin came down, and he was stretching, and when he stretched left, I stretched left, he stretched right, I said, you know, I was trying to figure out some kind of connection here. So then, you know, they had an interesting way that they introduced all the athletes for that particular track meet. In fact, what they did is they had you in what was called the marshalling area, and then they would ask you to they would call your name, and then you would jog out to your lane and get in your lane. And so they would call lane 1, Joe Schmo. He'd walk out, you know, and everybody would be cheering for him. They'd get to lane 2, they'd get to 3, they get to lane 4. The man, world record holder, winner of, and they just et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it just, the crowd, probably 12,000 people, maybe more, cheering wildly and loudly, and he marched out, and he was waving, and so I was the next one. So all of a sudden you just heard this mumbling sound, you know, through the all the noise of the cheering for Edwin, because he was yet to be at his lane. And the guy behind me tapped me on my shoulder and he said, "I think that's you." So of course I go jogging out to my lane. Not a soul in the crowd knows who I am. But if my mother was there, maybe she would have figured it out. But I get to my lane, and you gotta imagine at that time what the spectacle was when Edwin was in a race. And this was my first time really experiencing it. So I get to my lane, of course there's photographers in my lane, there's photographers standing on the side over here, they're all taking pictures, you know, using each other's tripods, heads as tripods, you know, whatever. They're just taking pictures. And I'm just sitting there just going, I can't believe this is happening, right? So long story short, you know, we get in the lane, the starter says, okay, runners, take your marks, get set. I stand up, I get in the set position, and for some strange reason, I decided I was going to put the peep gun to my arm just to see him one last time. And fortunately for me, the starter stopped us. He asked us to stand up, and he asked the photographers to, you know, stop clicking the cameras so that we can run this race. So the race runs, I take off. I'm running as fast as I can down the backstretch, and I'm going down the backstretch, and I'm wondering, where's Edwin? He's got to be here somewhere, because I know he's coming. And so we got around the fifth hurdle. I think it was going into the sixth hurdle. He came around me, and then he kept going. And I, you know, I finished up. I didn't do too bad. I ended up finishing fourth in that heat, and I needed to finish third in order to make the finals, but when I walked back towards the finish line, I was just so full of myself, just like, I just can't believe this just happened. And I walked past Edwin, and he stuck his hand out, we shook hands. And I went home, and I thought, man, that was my memory. That was my moment to really, you know, race against my idol and do something really special. Well, it didn't end there. I got home, and a couple of weeks later, I got called into my coach's office, and my coach said to me, "Richard, I have something for you." So I said, I was wondering what it was, and he passed me this envelope. So in this envelope was this little tiny picture. And when I opened up the picture had a note on it. It was from an anonymous person. And the note said, "I think Richard would want this." And so when I pulled it back, to my astonishment, there I was at the fifth hurdle with Edwin Moses tied. And believe me, when I went home, none of my friends believed this story, you know? So you all have seen that American Express commercial where it's priceless, you know, there's the moment, right? Well, I have this picture here today. And I've taken this picture, and I've actually blown this picture up. I've had it in my office for 25 years. Seriously, I mean, I've had it. If you've worked with me out in Worcester here and other places, I keep this picture in my office. I have it framed. I have it sitting there as a memory of, it's not just my own track career, but just that moment too. And it's been a special sort of moment, and it gives me great honor and pleasure to introduce Edwin here today. And I'm hoping at some point today he'll sign this picture, because that's the only thing that's missing. But it gives me an honor and a pleasure to introduce Edwin Moses today. Everybody knows about his tremendous accolades on the sports field, but he's an engineer. I've learned a lot about his foundation and other works that he's been involved in. But he's been not just a world record holder, Olympic champion, a great athlete. He's a humanitarian. He's just a phenomenal person. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome our chairman of the Major Taylor Association's Monument Committee to the podium. Edmund.
I'm going to have to verify this. Let me get a closer look. Let's see if I remember that right. Quentin Wheeler. That might be Andre Phillips. I'm in lane 4. You're in lane 5. It's pretty close. It's pretty close. It's a good one. If I was you, I would show this in my office too. But it's true. I'm just very pleased to be here to represent a lot of sportsmen who have found out about the story of Major Taylor, and especially the international sportsmen, cyclists, and people from all over the world who have heard about the story, because I've sent out hundreds of the links to the website, and people who follow me and look me up always tend to be reminded of the reason we are here today. It's a glorious day. It's been a long time. Lynn, thank you very much for even having gotten me involved many, many years ago. I was trying to find out exactly how long it was that we came together, but out of the clear blue sky, I got a call from Lynn, and she told me about the story, and I had no knowledge of Major Taylor at the time, and I heard the story, and it was something that I wanted to get involved with, and it's been a long, hard road. You've heard from several people up here how long and how hard and how treacherous the road has been. But today, I feel the wind blowing. I feel the wind blowing from the Worcester whirlwind. Everybody who's around here, I'm sure you can feel us involved and wrapped in the wind that's blowing today. It's a fantastic, beautiful day to be celebrating this great man. May 21st, 2008, fantastic and glorious day indeed. I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to be brief because everyone's told you about the stories of the hardships that Marshall Major Taylor has withstood. But there's three things that really come to my mind in treating and dealing with this whole story. And that's one of people, one of the politics of the time, and one of sport. And in terms of the people, everyone's heard the saying that evil has an ability to prevail when good men do nothing. Today, we're seeing the exact opposite. When good people want to do something, you can wipe out evil and make it right. One name that hasn't been mentioned today. Anyone who's read the book, The Coach and the Manager, Lewis Munger, I think is a name that we have to talk about today, because he took a chance with the major and supported him, got him in races, and was with him all the way. The Major Taylor Association, the state of Massachusetts, the city of Worcester, Antonio Mendez, Senator Harriet Chandler, Lynn Tolman, and all the host of other people that Lynn mentioned, and all the other groups of supporters who have made this possible. Those are the people who have changed this around. In terms of politics, my organization has gone by the mantra of one of the most famous people in the world, Nelson Mandela. And when Nelson Mandela came to our initial event, we had a speech prepared for him that he read. And after he gave his prepared speech, he gave a speech from the heart. And in it, he said that sport has the power to change the world. It can give hope where there once was despair. Today, ladies and gentlemen, is a day for hope, a day of hope. The Major Taylor story is very, very important. If you don't understand the history of what he went through, then it's bound to repeat itself. And today we're making an acknowledgement of what's happened and honoring a great man. When it comes to sport, many are called, but few are chosen. Today, we are calling back one that through his deeds and actions chose himself to be honored here today. One who was subjected to racial discrimination and hatred of the Jim Crow era, who relocated himself voluntarily here to the city of Worcester, then became the best, most prolific cyclist of his time. Marshall Major Taylor is a man of all times in the world of sports, the first African-American international sports star. Now, we all know of a lot of the trials and tribulations of other African-Americans that have suffered from discrimination and their stories. Arthur Ashe in the 1970s, Jackie Robinson, in 1947. Also, Tommy Smith, the 1968 Olympics. Muhammad Ali suffered a lot. Henry Aaron in 1974. Jack Johnson in the 1920s. Jesse Owens, in 1936. Today, we are here to recognize forever the person who has been missing from this list, the person who should be first on the list. After today, Marshall Major Taylor will take his rightful spot at the top of this distinguished list after more than 100 years. It's been 100 years. So for me, it's an honor and a privilege to be here. We've been waiting for this day for years and years and years, and I just can't wait to see the statue. I know it's going to be fantastic and beautiful. And Stacy, something that you said was very, very important. It's all about the kids, because the children who will come here and see this statue, our future is in the children. The children are going to be running our country. We're going through a lot here in terms of politics and racism and discrimination and the politics of the day. We need to look back and really make peace with ourselves on these issues. But it's the kids that are going to make the difference. And when we educate those kids and give them the opportunity to be at peace with themselves, regardless of what color, what religion, what gender, what type of situation you come from, we've made a very, very big difference. Now, without further ado, it gives me the honor and privilege of going up right just a little bit and going from Major Taylor. We're going to go straight to his grandson, General Dallas Brown. I'm going to have you come up and give some words. And we appreciate your family being here, all of you. It's just a fantastic, wonderful day. So you're going to hear from your general now.
Good afternoon. As Major Taylor's grandson, his only grandchild,
I feel deeply honored to be here. And I must admit, this is difficult for me. And I've given, I don't know, hundreds of talks, speeches, briefings in my military career. But this is very different. It's hard. I guess the reason is I care. I care a great deal. So bear with me, please. I want to tell you a story, briefly. The story of being here today, physically being here. We were invited to attend several months ago, and I thought, fine, we'll go, be very appropriate, and we'll go and stay in Boston in a hotel, the Back Bay Hilton, where my son Greg is the general manager. He's here today. Well, then about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I looked at a map, a Massachusetts map, and I should have known. Boston is 40-plus miles from Worcester. Is that the way you pronounce it? Worcester? I'm learning. Ms. Tolman recommended the Hilton Garden Inn in Worcester. So I looked that up and got it up on a computer and thought about the distance and the time. I can't drive back and forth to Boston. Got to stay in Worcester. Okay, so where to stay? She said Hilton Garden Inn. So I got that up on a computer and tried to make a reservation. It's 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it said, not available. And I thought, why wouldn't it be available? Why would a hotel be booked solid 2 or 3 weeks in advance? I sat there staring at the computer, and at the top of the screen, it had the address. The Hilton Garden Inn, 25 Major Taylor Boulevard. And I had a blinding flash of the obvious. Worcester is celebrating my grandfather, a genuine American hero. And it brought tears to my eyes. It brings them back. My grandfather passed 76 years ago this month, about 2 months before I was born. So I never knew him. And my mother didn't talk very much about him until recently. She passed in 2005. But a few years before that, she began to tell me things about him and her life as a child. I realized then and now that my mother felt a bit guilty, responsible for the sad circumstances surrounding his death. And she, of course, was not responsible in any way. And she was also embarrassed by the great amount of attention that she got by being his daughter. Some of you gentlemen here are guilty of talking to her, calling her, wanting interviews, writing articles, books, a movie, and went on. And she was always somewhat embarrassed because it was reflected glory. And I feel that because I have done essentially nothing to enhance his legacy. I understand some things about him that have been mentioned today. His determination under adverse circumstances throughout his life, and his character, a religious man, deeply held beliefs, things like not racing on Sunday, no alcohol, no tobacco, no swearing, and a forgiving spirit toward his enemies and adversaries. It's character. And then he had, obviously, a great deal of courage, both physical and moral. I don't know much about courage, but I do know something about danger, because I've been through my share of physical danger. But reflecting on that, particularly Vietnam, where I commanded a battalion of about 800 soldiers. I had the loyalty of most of my soldiers, and my officers were supportive. In other words, I was never alone. I always had other men with me. And that kept me going, got me through it. But Major Taylor faced his battles essentially alone. His wife and a few others, of course, supported him. But he had a type of courage that I don't really comprehend. I can just imagine it. I think today, Major Taylor would be very proud of this monument. In his quiet way, he would be proud. But I think he would be more proud of his descendants, starting with my mother. She was an athlete in her own right. She attended Sargent. And she was the first director of women's physical education at my alma mater, our family college in West Virginia, West Virginia State University. My mother, the first women's physical education director. She mentioned to me a few times about how the other instructors looked at her strangely because she was walking around in a gym costume. Well, she persevered at that. And later, during World War II, she was a Red Cross field director in Europe. She went ashore at Normandy about 2 weeks after D-Day and made her way to Paris. And she directed a Red Cross club there and later another in Reims. My mother. Then I have five children. All of them, I'm proud of them, of course. All of them achievers in various fields of endeavor. I want to add my thanks to that of others, to Lynn Tolman. She had some help from several of you who are here, but she built this organization. She's responsible for it. She doesn't get paid. And along the way, she worked to get this done, this beautiful monument to my grandfather. I think, Carol, I'll turn it over to you for further comments from the Taylor Brown Donovan family.
Tough act to follow, but I'll do my best. It is truly an honor to be here today, and it's also a very emotional day for me. About 10 years ago, the Major Taylor Association told me about their plans to commission this statue. And at the time, I was a little on the pessimistic side. I thought, this is such an enormous undertaking. But throughout the years, they proved me wrong. They probably proved a lot of people wrong. Their members have worked tirelessly, and their supporters, to achieve this goal. And I believe that their hard work and their dedication was fueled by a passion to see a happy ending to an unfinished story. I remember telling my grandmother, Sydney Taylor Brown, about their efforts. And she was absolutely delighted. Worcester was her childhood home, and this was where she had some of her favorite memories of her father. She died in 2005 at the age of 101. I wish she could be here. She led an amazing life herself, as my father said, and it was worthy of its own book. So, Andrew, maybe you could do part two on the life of Sydney. Among the things she left me were many old photographs. And Richard, you weren't the only one that brought a picture today. I have one here. It was taken 90 years ago in Worcester, right here, outside of their family home. I know you can't see it, but I'll describe it for you. It shows a very young Sydney, probably 12 or 13 years old. She's all dressed up. She's got a huge grin on her face, and she looks like life has been very good to her. And I love this picture. I've been looking at it a lot in the past few weeks, and as I look at it again today, I want to tell all of you that I know with the certainty that if she could be here today, there is nothing that would give her greater joy than to see this statue dedicated in a place she held so dear in her heart. This beautiful tribute to my great-grandfather assures that his legacy will never be forgotten. Thank you so much. I'd like to switch gears a little bit. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you a living cycling legend. He's one of the Raleigh boys who stormed Europe in the 1970s and showed for the first time since Major Taylor's triumphs on the continent that Americans could compete at the highest level of the sport. In addition, this top-notch rider, coach, and steward of cycling history helped lay the foundation for recognition of my great-grandfather. He was also the director of the Worcester Whirlwind Bike Race in 1980 and 1981. Please welcome Bill Humphreys.
I'm honored to be here and to be connected in any way and to have started the flame that Lynn got a hold of and wouldn't let go of. It's just phenomenal. And to know that when I made the call to him and Lynn said, gee, we're going to try to get somebody here, I said, well, don't worry about that guy. Let me call Greg. I got through to him and he said, I'm there. You know, I said, we don't have a lot of money. You know, we know what your fees are and all this. He says, nah, that's not a problem. The major was a key part of my life. He was an inspiration to me my whole career. Those were the words from the kid to me last November or December when I called him. And he didn't know about it. I mean, he knew the major, but he didn't know this was happening. So to know that the major influenced the guy that went out and won the Tour de France for the first time and then for the second time and then got horrendous and came back to win it the third time, that tells you quite a bit. So it's an honor for me to introduce your next speaker, Greg LeMond.
Thank you. I think Bill was trying to be restrained on telling stories about when I was 16 years old at the Olympic Training Center, which he doesn't want to repeat. I was a bottled-up testosterone kid with no training. We were snowed in and locked into a cage at the Olympic Training Center. So we had a very good introduction. But it is, for me, as a cyclist, in looking back at my start of cycling, it is really a special day for even to have the privilege to be asked to honor Major Taylor. Because when I look back at when I started cycling in 1976, I kind of didn't even know about the sport. I was a skier, wanted to get in shape for cycling, got into it. When I first started winning races, I heard about the Tour de France. And, you know, it was probably within 6 months, maybe a year of racing, that my great-grandmother was born in 1888. She said, oh, yeah, I remember. Cycling was really big when I was growing up. And she talked about the six-day races. It turns out my great-grandmother's cousin was a manager, trainer for some six-day racers back in 1910, 1920s. But it was really still almost 3 years later of racing that I heard about Major Taylor, probably 78, 79. I started reading about Major Taylor and seeing what, you know, if you got to understand where cycling was back in the turn of the century and the early, you know, 1910, 1920s, it was the top sport. Remember, the Olympic movement started in the 1890s. The Tour de France started in 1903. And the sport at the time was cycling. And it was a sport dominated by white men, Western Europeans, Americans. And to think, if I just remember showing up to my first race at 16 from the West Coast to the East Coast and feeling so out of place, like, almost wet my pants, just hearing the coach tell me how they're going to select the world team. And that was, you know, coming from the West Coast to the East Coast, to imagine Major Taylor at a young age of 17, 18, showing up at a race against a crowd of, especially at this time, post-Civil War, in Indiana, with a lot of white racers, and then dominating and, you know, really pulling all this attention to himself. I know what it feels like just to be kind of a target, but a target is a competitor, but to be a target of racial discrimination, I think what really, to me, separates Major Taylor to any other athlete, and probably there's not just Major Taylor, any athlete who's ever had to overcome discrimination. You know, I think we all, the world has improved dramatically, but there's still discrimination going on today. To have to face that, sports hard enough as it is, or life is hard enough as it is, but to have to go through that additional emotional trauma is really what separates people. And I think that what Major Taylor's, you know, everybody looks at winning the Tour de France seems like a great exploit. And it is. I mean, but it's very self-centered, narcissistic. It's, you know, my goal to do that. And you know, one is focused on that goal. And there's a lot of self-gratification in it, and you get something back. And that's part of what creates determination, goal setting. But what separates Major Taylor, and I think there are very few athletes that have what I call courage. And courage is really the ability to stand up for what you believe in spite of the naysayers, in spite of the shame and the public humiliation. That's what really Major Taylor jumps away from the pack from anybody else. He was able to endure in a sport that was very competitive. And we talk about the combinations or the combines of the working against each other. That happens in cycling just normally because there's drafting. To think that he had the normal challenges that a bike racer has, but in addition to physical, he had physical threats, political threats, backhanded deals against him, makes his career that much more remarkable. And it truly is. I hope this statue can be a symbol of hope and most importantly courage. And I think I hope that the Taylor family can look at, and I wish Major was here today, but hopefully this year will be, I think it is remarkable in the last 100 years. For Major Taylor, it's like Muhammad Ali having a career and then being eclipsed by a war, and everybody's forgotten about him for 100 years. And it is really an honor to be here. And I can't wait to see the statue, and I do hope that it does inspire others to overcome and think about other humans as humans, not by race or color. Thank you.
Okay, it's showtime. I want to ask Karen Brown Donovan, as representative of the Taylor family, Edwin Moses, Greg LeMond, Lynn Tolman, and sculptor Toby Mendez to join me for the honors.
And now the dignitaries are untying the rope that's holding the parachute in place, covering the monument of Major Taylor. And now they're slowly pulling the parachute back. It catches on the far corner momentarily. The committee's having a difficult time now. As now the parachute is being pulled back over the top. The legs of Major Taylor revealed, and now the body. And now finally the head of Marshal Major Taylor. Dark gray marble base with the capital letters Major Taylor written in gold. Granite arises from behind the dark gray base. Large granite monolith. In front of it in bas-relief, in front of a grandstand, is the figure emerging from the bas-relief into a full sculpture, the figure of Marshal Major Taylor. We're standing now on the backside of the monument to Major Taylor. tall granite structure, about 10, 12 feet tall, about 15 feet wide. Large bronze plaque in bas-relief, three racers staggered, coming from behind and passing from the outside. Major Taylor of France, 1903, depicts Major Taylor in the as the third place racer. Below the bronze bas-relief, which is about 3 feet down from the top and about a border of 2 feet on either side, the bronze plaque itself is approximately 8 feet wide and about 4 feet tall. Beneath it, carved into the granite, Marshal Walter Major Taylor, world champion cyclist at the turn of the 20th century, when bicycle racing was more popular than baseball. The biggest draw of all was Major Taylor, lived from 1878 to 1932. The Worcester Whirlwind. He held seven world records in 1989 and won the one-mile sprint at the 1899 World Championships in Montreal, becoming the second black world champion in any sport and the first African-American international sports superstar. He had to fight racial prejudice both on and off his bike. He faced closed doors and open hostility with remarkable dignity to become the fastest bicycle rider in the world, as he titles his autobiography. We hope you enjoyed this special presentation on Marshal Major Taylor, brought to you by the African American Experience, produced by the Audio Journal and the Roy Allen Project, and broadcast with the assistance of the Talking Information Center, the statewide radio reading service for individuals who are blind, visually impaired, or those otherwise unable to access visual material. For copies of today's program or for more information about the service, please contact Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606, or call 508-797-1117, or email info@audiojournal.net. I'm Vince Lombardi. Thanks for listening, and tune into the African American Experience on the fourth Saturday of each month at 9 p.m. You're listening to the Massachusetts Reading Network. We can.